This is Commissioner Steve Kolbeck. I'll be running the meeting today. We're just waiting on a couple of things for those of you listening on the internet. We should get started within the next few minutes. Thank you. Commissioner Kolbeck, I'm going to call the meeting to order. TC08-135. Right now, we're going to go into recess for a half hour to give the party some time to talk about a settlement discussion. So we are in recess until 9:30. This is Commissioner Kolbeck again. For those of you listening on the internet, it's about 25 after 9. We will actually extend our recess until 10 p.m. So we will be in recess. I'm sorry, 10 a.m. Well, or
yes, let's do that.
Yeah, on the 22nd here. So maybe till 10 tomorrow. 10 a.m. On the 22nd. It's 9:25 right now. We will not be back in session until 10 a.m. Yep. Thanks. Internet, and we'll confirm that. This is Commissioner Steve Kolbeck, and we will call to order this meeting of TC, this hearing of TC08-135. We will begin the hearing in DACA TC08-135 in the matter of the complaint filed by OrbitCom Incorporated against Verizon Business Network Services Incorporated regarding unpaid access charges. The time is approximately 10 a.m. The date is October 22nd, 2009, and the location of the hearing is in room 413, State Capitol, Pierre, South Dakota. I am Steve Kolbeck, Commission Vice Chairman. Commissioners Gary Hansen is also present with me. Commissioner Dusty Johnson is sick and probably listening on the internet right now but cannot participate in person. I'm presiding over the hearing. The hearing was noticed pursuant to the Commission's order for the notice of hearing issued October 8, 2009. The issues to be determined by the Commission are the issues raised by OrbitCom's amended complaint, Verizon's answer to amended complaint and counterclaim, and OrbitCom's reply to amended counterclaim involving the parties' respective payment and or refund or credit obligations to the other for the provisions of the billing and payment for switched access service. All parties have the right to be present and to be represented by an attorney. All persons testifying will be sworn in and subject to cross-examination by the parties. The Commission's final decision may be appealed by the parties to the State Circuit Court and State Supreme Court. John Smith, the Commission's counsel, will act as hearing examiner and will conduct the hearing subject to the Commission's oversight. He may provide recommended rulings on procedure and evidentiary matters. The Commission may overrule its counsel's preliminary rulings throughout the hearing. If not overruled, the preliminary rulings will become final rulings. At this time, I will turn over the hearing to John Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why don't we begin by taking the appearances of the parties. Ms. Moore, would you please begin?
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of OrbitCom this morning. Present with me is OrbitCom's in-house counsel, Pat Mastel. Also seated with us is Michael Powers, the CFO, and also present on behalf of OrbitCom is Brad Van Leer, the president.
Thank you, Mr. Gerdes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer in Peer, and I represent Verizon Business. With me the lawyer that will conduct the hearing is Thomas Dixon of Denver, Colorado. Mr. Dixon has been admitted pro hoc vice, and that order has been entered and is on file with the circuit court. I would also mention that Richard Severy, also a lawyer with Chevron, is at counsel table. And Mr. Severy is from San Francisco. Excuse me, Verizon. If I said Chevron, don't ask me why I said that.
Thank you, Ms. Kramer.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer with staff, and joining me is Terry LaBrie Baker.
Thank you. Are there any preliminary matters that the parties wish to bring before the commission before we jump in?
Please, Mr. Smith, prior to commencing the hearing this morning, Mr. Dixon and I had an opportunity to discuss the exhibits, which will be introduced as part of the hearing. and we have agreed to stipulate to the admission of Orbitcom's or complainants' exhibits 1 through 6, and have also agreed to stipulate to the admissibility of Verizon's exhibits, which are lettered, and those are lettered A through D. Additionally, we have agreed in regard to complainant's exhibit number 2 to strike certain testimony, which begins on page 30 and would run from lines 18 through 24, and page 31, lines 1 through 4, and we will take care of that in the exhibit, which has already been pre-marked by the court reporter here this morning. And then finally, there were some materials which have been inadvertently disclosed to the public, which were intended to be marked as confidential. Mr. Dixon and I have discussed those. I've had an opportunity to talk with Ms. Kramer about remedying that situation. We will take care of that after the hearing is over and ensure that everything that is marked as confidential is accorded the appropriate treatment. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are we going to know here, in case we have that material come before the commission, can you please advise us when that occurs so we know? Bottom line, I think everybody in the room I don't think we've got anybody in the room who we need to eject, but we will have to shut off our communications to the internet if we have confidential materials come up. So just let me know. With that, then, do the parties wish to make opening statements to the commission before we begin?
I prepared a few brief comments, please, Mr. Smith.
Okay, thank you. And would the other parties prefer to reserve that right until their case in chief begins?
Yes, Mr. Smith, I was going to make that request. And just for the record, Ms. Moore has correctly stated our agreement regarding the stipulation as the testimony. The only additional matter is we also agreed that to the extent we offer data responses into the record, we'll stipulate to their admissibility as well.
Okay, thank you. And I should ask, too, staff, do you have an objection to the stipulation?
Staff does not.
Thank you. Ms. Moore, please proceed with your opening statement.
Excuse me. I'm assuming they're all admitted then at this time.
Yes, I will admit those. Thank you for reminding me.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Good morning, commissioners, staff. The complaint currently before the commissions has its origins in essentially the non-payment of what we believe the evidence will show were validly billed invoices for traffic from Verizon. Orbitcom, in this particular case, has provided Verizon with originating and terminating access services. In accordance with their tariff and industry standard practices, they jurisdictionalized that traffic or applied the appropriate percentage of interstate use, or PIU factor, according to their tariff, and they then applied the appropriate rate to that traffic, which was then, of course, billed to Verizon. We believe that the evidence will show here that Verizon did not properly dispute those bills, but rather simply refused to pay those bills, which we believe the evidence will show was an inappropriate resort to self-help. There were discussions between the parties in the hopes that we could ascertain what the nature of the dispute was, but we believe the evidence will show that Orbitcom's personnel was not provided with the appropriate information in order to best ascertain what Verizon's dispute with the bills ultimately was. And we believe what the evidence will show this commission is that Verizon improperly withheld payment for validly billed intrastate charges in exchange for what they believed were interstate overcharges. We'll be presenting testimony today from Michael Powers, who is the CFO of Verizon, in support of all the arguments. And at the conclusion of this hearing, we will be asking that the commission affirm Orbitcom's tariff, affirm the process by which it jurisdictionalized the traffic, which was billed to Verizon for the time period in dispute, and to affirm that the rate that was applied to the traffic at issue was correct. And we will be asking for a judgment in the amount that will be testified to by Mr. Powers. Additionally, we will be asking that this commission deny Verizon's counterclaim. Thank you.
Okay. And as I understand, the other parties do not wish to make opening statements now, but to reserve that.
On behalf of Verizon, Mr. Smith, that's correct. And just for the record, mm-hmm. when I refer to Verizon, as you know, the actual caption refers to MCI Communication Services and TeleConnect Long Distance Services. My reference to Verizon incorporates both of those entities to make it easier and not have to state that mouthful of names each and every time. So just for the benefit of everybody, when I reference Verizon, that's what I am talking about.
Okay, and I think that'll probably be the case with all of us. With that, Ms. Moore, please proceed with your direct case. Call your first witness.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Orbitcom calls Michael Powers. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Mr. Powers, would you please introduce yourself to the commission?
My name is Michael Powers. I'm CFO of Orbitcom. I think Meredith said I was CFO of Verizon. I'm not sure if I got promoted or demoted, but I am CFO of Orbitcom. Thanks.
Excuse me, Mr. Powers, my apologies. You've indicated by whom you were employed. Can you describe for the commission what Orbitcom is and what Orbitcom does, please?
Orbitcom is what's known in this industry as a CLEC, and actually a specialized form of a CLEC. We're a ULEC in that we use an unbundled network elements plus a switching platform to provide services. And we provide local long-distance telephone services to customers in South Dakota and 13 other states.
How long has Orbitcom been in business, Mr. Powers?
It started in business in South Dakota in 2002.
Does Orbitcom have on file with this commission a tariff?
We do.
And what name is that tariff under?
It's in one of our exhibits. It's in Orbitcom. It was originally filed under VP Telecom. Shortly after that, we changed our name. It was a name change only, so the tariff is under Orbitcom.
Mr. Powers, you provided pre-filed testimony in this particular matter, correct?
Yes, I have.
And you provided pre-filed direct testimony, pre-filed rebuttal testimony, and pre-filed supplemental rebuttal testimony. Is that correct?
Yes, I have.
And can you please summarize for the commission the purpose of the testimony that you provided?
I think the purpose of the testimony was to give the commission an outline of what the issues are here and some of the exhibits show the interchange that has taken place so far, and basically all of the facts that have brought us to this point today.
Mr. Powers, what are the two primary issues before the commission today, in your opinion?
Well, I believe that we're asking the primary issues before this commission, in which they have jurisdiction over, are a couple of, apparently they're tariff issues. It has to do with tandem switching versus use of direct end-office trunking. The other issue is that how the percentage of interstate use is calculated on unknown traffic.
Let's start with the PIU issue, please. Can you describe for the commission what you believe the PIU issue is before them?
Now, the PIU stands for percentage of interstate use, and the issue here that I believe is Verizon does not believe we have applied the correct percentage to the bills that we have sent them for unknown traffic. It is a significant issue in that the if the percentage is applied wrong, there's quite a financial implication. The interstate rate for access service is approximately one-tenth of the intrastate rate. It might be said that the might add the interstate rate it was at one time considerably higher. It's been replaced with subscriber line charges and other things. So if they take a certain amount of minutes and if they're jurisdictionalized or billed at an interstate jurisdiction, they're going to be quite a bit lower than they would if they were billed at an intrastate jurisdiction and vice versa. So both parties are concerned that it be done as accurately and fairly as possible.
Does Orbitcom's tariff provide a process by which Orbitcom calculates the PIU?
It does.
Can you describe that for the commission, please?
Well, there are several options. There are several processes, actually, depending on the circumstances. First of all, if we can determine actual jurisdiction of a phone call, and our billing system can determine that, we bill by actual jurisdiction. In other words, if we're going to bill access for an intrastate call, because we can see that it originated in South Dakota and it terminated in South Dakota, then that one can be assigned, can be billed accurately. And the same with an interstate call. So if we can determine jurisdiction by the originating phone number and terminating telephone number, we bill it according to that. If we can't determine that, and this is, you know, an industry norm, is that you set a percentage of interstate use to apply to the unknown traffic. And this can be done a variety of ways. In our tariff, it says that we will develop, the company, meaning us, will develop a percentage of interstate use to apply. Third of all, we can accept information from the customer on what they believe to be the percentage of interstate use and use that or take that into consideration in developing the percentage that we're going to use for that particular customer and that particular type of traffic.
Which method did Orbitcom use to calculate the PIU that it used for Verizon's traffic?
During what time period?
During the initial time period. And I'd like you to tell the commission what that is, please.
The initial time period? You might be losing me there, Meredith. What we started billing MCI/Verizon in 2002.
Certainly. At the time period at issue in this particular dispute, what process did Orbitcom use to calculate the PIU?
Up until May of this year, we used what we have in our tariff as the default PIU. In other words, if we haven't used any of the other methods, it goes to a default PIU, which is at, I believe, 32% as percentage of interstate usage. And that default PIU was developed over time, you know, based on what we knew to be our own calling patterns and those of our customers. So it really wasn't random. It was developed on information much the same as we would for an individual customer, only we did it. It applies to all the customers that we haven't done anything else with.
And do you believe that the PIU that was applied to Verizon's traffic, specifically the 3268, which you speak of, is an accurate PIU?
I do.
And on what do you base that?
Again, when I said in my pre-file testimony that we've had a lot of experience in this business here and in this market, Brad and I have been We come like some of the people here from MCI. We came from the inter-exchange carrier business, which we've been in South Dakota since the early 1980s off and on. We're selling to the same customers we've had all off and on, a lot of the same people and a lot of the same customers, but certainly the same customer type that we've had for 20-some years now. We tend to sell to small business customers. We have around 2,000 customers and 6,000 service lines in South Dakota. So you're looking at an average of about 3 lines per customer. So we're really the ultra small business. And so we've purchased a lot of inter-exchange service, and we sold a lot of inter-exchange service before this. And we found that to be a fairly consistent overall pattern for that particular customer base.
Did Verizon dispute the application of the 3268 PIU?
Yes, they did.
Did you have an understanding of why they did that?
Eventually I did, yes.
And when you say eventually, can you explain what you mean by that to the commission, please?
The disputes were sometimes hard to, and I've covered this in my pre-file testimony, it was kind of hard to understand exactly what they were disputing and over what time period and why. But eventually, we have reached that understanding.
And what is your understanding?
Of what they're disputing?
Correct.
Yes, they're disputing the use of the percentage of interstate use at 32%. I might add that for a period of time, I believe they've identified it as July of 07 to July of 08, we applied a percentage of interstate use of 5% to Verizon traffic. And it's pretty clear that they're disputing that.
What was the basis for the application of the 5% PIU factor, Mr. Powers?
On the originating traffic, the basis was Orbitcom as a CLEC chooses who the customer is going to use for a long distance carrier. So we're a CLEC. We're also an inter-exchange carrier, and we choose for the customer. In fact, we have to, according to our contract with Qwest. We have to choose the carriers. And in today's world, you get two picks. You get two picks, literally. You get a pick for your interstate calls, and you get what's called an L pick or a LATA pick for your, in South Dakota's case, your intrastate calls. So if we use a certain carrier, and just to back up a little bit, out of all we probably bill 50 to 55 customers for access. Only 3 or 4 of those are going to have any originating access to speak of, because those will be the ones that we pick our customers to use. And it's not unusual for us to find that, again, we're doing business in 14 states, that certain carriers will have a better intrastate rate than others, and certain ones will have a better interstate rate, and then it becomes state specific. So they may flip flop in the next state, or there may be some overlap. So we use a grid to kind of pick the carrier based on that. In this case, the 5% was we used for a period of time. We used Verizon as an L pick, and that means in South Dakota and almost all the other states, there's very few LATAs that cross state lines, that those calls will be virtually all intrastate with a few exceptions. That is how we set the originating. The terminating and 800 service were set at 5% due to a mistake by me in not differentiating between the traffic. In fact, I have to plead a little bit of ignorance. I didn't even know that all of that came into play. I said we just need to set this PIU differently because we're using them exclusively as an LPIC without realizing it would affect the other services as well.
And in this case, how would you resolve to take care of the issue that you just identified, Mr. Powers?
Well, I would. I have offered to Verizon that I would adjust the terminating and 800 traffic for that time period to the 32% PIU. It would be fairly easy to calculate a number, or just a, there's a certain number of minutes involved at each at the interstate rate and the intrastate rate, and we can reallocate the minutes and calculate an accurate credit for them.
Mr. Powers, I believe you testified that up until May of 2009, Orbitcom applied the PIU factor of 3268, correct?
That is correct.
In May of 2009, after May of 2009, how did Orbitcom calculate the PIU that it applied to the traffic at issue?
After May of 2009, we were able to bill by jurisdiction. We've been working on that project for some time. We actually had been using a service bureau to bill our calls. And early in 2009, we bought the hardware and negotiated the software deal necessary to do our own billing. And it's actually the same software we were using before. It's an upgraded version, and it's not on a service bureau basis, but rather we do it ourselves. And with the available, like you said, with the upgraded and a couple of other things, more processing space, we're able to bill by actual jurisdiction now if the information is contained in the call record.
And is that method, the billing by actual jurisdiction, is that a method outlined in Orbitcom's tariff?
It is one of the methods, yes it is.
And did Verizon dispute the billing by jurisdiction?
It seems that they have now, yes.
And when you say it seems that they have, what do you mean by that?
Well, we were sensitive to Verizon's concerns about billing by a PIU, and one of the things that they had said repeatedly was that if we were to bill by a jurisdiction, it would solve this problem that we have. However, we have been doing that for 4 months now. We submitted call samples to verify the bills. Apparently, the samples were not even disputed. That they show that the actual percentage of interstate use on the known traffic on the bills we've seen so far, at least the ones for June of 2009. Was around 27% rather than 32%, and yet we received a dispute about that, which I understand how they calculated the dispute. I don't think it's accurate, and I have a very difficult time understanding why it's even in place. We build by jurisdiction. The call detail records show that it was accurately jurisdictionalized. And so I'm rather disappointed because a number of times Verizon said if we would bill by a jurisdiction, it would solve this problem and they would pay us.
At any point in time, since the initial dispute was raised in this matter by Verizon, has Verizon made payment on any of the bills sent to it by Orbitcom?
Yes, there's been some payment. I think a basic outline of it is in February of 2008, I believe they filed a dispute or alleged dispute, filed a claim. It ended up being around $283,000 in interstate charges that they were disputing. They almost immediately began withholding all payments, inter and intrastate, until they had withheld that amount. And then they paid their bills either in partial or in full, in partial to even the amount out that they wanted to withhold. And then in full for a short period of time, I'm thinking around 2 months, and up till around June of 2008. Then they filed another dispute regarding percentage of interstate use, tandem switching. It's labeled a PIU tandem switching DIOT dispute for $1 million and some dollars, and I don't believe they paid any significant amount since then. There may have been small payments on small bands, but basically nothing significant. I say that because we actually, I think, have 43 billing account numbers with Verizon and in 14 different states. So there could have been a payment here or there, but the majority of it has not been paid, no.
Mr. Powers, through the discovery process in this complaint proceeding, have you had an opportunity to examine records that have been submitted to Orbitcom by Verizon that they believe support their PIU factor?
I have.
And what's your impression of why Verizon's proposed PIU is not accurate?
Well, first of all, I don't think we ever received any records, and according to our tariff, that's one of the things they can do is submit records to, if they don't like the percentage of interstate use we're billing them. After we bill by jurisdiction, we received a number of records, and it's contained in, are you talking about the stuff that's contained in Exhibit LF-37?
Correct.
So we received a number of recalculations and et cetera supported by data in LF-37, and what that amounted to was about, seems like it was 50-some thousand phone calls or 60-some thousand phone calls that Verizon said went through their switches at, during the same time period. And the search criteria, as ours outlined in the supplemental testimony, the search criteria were KIC 555 and the Orbitcom Annies and time frames. So I was really quite surprised that they submit this, and I looked at all of the records, and of course by submitting more records and adding them to the pre-jurisdictionalized total, they came up with a recalculated PIU, and it didn't make much sense to me. It would certainly lower the PIU, but it would raise the bill because our records had already been billed by jurisdiction. And so I guess now that we had jurisdictionalized our billing, they wanted us to unjurisdictionalize the calls and mix them in some sort of a pool. So don't really get the logic of it. I think I may have outlined that in my pre-filed testimony. I got curious as to how this could be, and so I started looking more closely at this data supported by LF, the exhibit labeled LF-37, and I find that out of these, it turned out to be about 52,000 phone calls they submitted. 22,000 didn't have Verizon's KIC of 555 on it. I don't think it had any. They had any Verizon KIC on them. And we prepared an exhibit to show that. Have you submitted that, or would you like to do that now?
That has been submitted, Mr. Powers. And for your reference, I believe they're in front of you. That would be Exhibit 5.
Should we look at that now?
I'm sorry, Ms. Moore. This is Commissioner Kobach. I just wanted to make sure the confidential, the internet is on, so if we're going to go into your exhibits, just keep that in mind.
Correct. Thank you. And Mr. Powers, if you would like to go through that now, that has been identified as a confidential exhibit, and we would need to go off the web.
We'll go off right now then.
You filed testimony. You also addressed a second issue, and that was whether Orbitcom appropriately billed the proper rate to Verizon. And a component of that was whether Orbitcom can bill the tandem switching element of the rate. Would you please talk with the commission about how Orbitcom came to the conclusion that it could properly bill Verizon the rate that it did?
Yeah, certainly. As I said, Orbitcom is a CLEC and a little bit different brand than some of us are familiar with because we are a ULEC. A traditional CLEC, we have a couple of them in Sioux Falls, the Mid-Continent, Prairie Wave, that the commission may be familiar with. They usually own their own local switch, and they may, in the case of a cable company, have facilities in the ground, so they own some of their local loops as well, or reasonable facsimiles of local loops. There are also CLECs that just lease the loops from Quest, the copper wires in the ground. And they do the local switching, and in the event of long-distance call, a likely scenario then is that they would transfer it to the, say, the Quest tandem for Quest to then hand it off to the inter-exchange carrier. So an access call sometimes is three or four components to it. There's the local switching and the local transport, the tandem switching and the tandem transport, and they may be handled by two or more local exchange carriers. And that being the case, each carrier should only bill for the part that it does. And that's in the industry, there's been some contention of which part did you do and which part did we do. And some carriers have tried to bill for the entire function when they only provided part of it. In Orbitcom's case, we lease the entire switching platform from Quest. And it's a combination of agreements now. It was a statement of general terms and conditions that Quest issued after the Telecom Act of 1996 for guys like us to buy out of. At that time, that included switching as one of the elements you could purchase out of the... Quest was basically mandated to sell, along with the other elements. There was a court case, and the result was called a TRRO, a Triennial Review or Remand Order, and the net result being that the LECs no longer had to sell switching as part of the services they were offering us. And so we opted into a commercial agreement to purchase switching from Quest called a QPP, and then later supplemented by another agreement called a QLSP. In that QLSP and the other agreements, the QPP in particular, it defines what we lease from Quest, and we lease all of the switching functions, including the tandem switching. The agreement also clearly states that once an end user is converted to a UniP service like ours in our contract, that Quest will not bill for access services for that ANI because we get to do it.
What's your understanding, Mr. Powers, of why Verizon believes that Orbitcom cannot bill it for the tandem switching element?
Well, I reread the testimony last night, and again, it's somewhat vague. There's allegations in there that we don't provide the tandem switching, that perhaps someone else does. Maybe they're thinking Quest, I don't know. But there's an allegation that it seems like that we don't provide the switching and therefore we can't bill for it. The other rationale seems to be tied to that Verizon has direct end office trunking, which in this case would be circuits directly from Verizon's inter-exchange carrier switch to the central offices in South Dakota, bypassing the tandem, which is a common arrangement if the traffic will justify it. So instead of going through the tandem and paying the tandem switching, they run a line directly to the central office that they want to pick up their traffic there. And to do that, you need to pay Quest, in this case, for an entrance facility fee and a couple of other fees that are in their tariff.
Based upon your knowledge, Mr. Powers, and what you've seen in this case, does Verizon have any DOTs with Orbitcom?
Well, we've had some beta requests about that and some informal requests, and we received quite a number of things. We asked for circuit IDs, and we weren't really satisfied with what we got there. And we asked for access service requests, bills, any types of evidence. We have quite a number of documents, most of which we just received in the last few days. I think the claim that Verizon made was they had DOTs to virtually every single central office of Quest in South Dakota, with a couple of exceptions. They actually gave us a list, which I believe is included in one of the exhibits somewhere. So the conclusion I have at this point is that Verizon, there's a pretty good chance they have one in Sioux Falls. The evidence, the documentation shows that the circuits between Quest and Verizon are often used for, the same circuit is used for a direct connect with the CO. It's used for the tandem traffic. It's used for cellular traffic. All combined, which is legal, and it is a service offering from Quest that I can understand. So I'm not questioning that. I'm just saying it's kind of hard to sort out exactly what is direct end office trunking. And there's a further explanation with that, if you want me to, about the technological changes that have brought that about.
Mr. Powers, in your opinion, is a DOT to Quest the same thing as a DOT to Orbitcom?
Yeah, no, it is not.
Why not?
Under the KLSP agreement that we have, Orbitcom has the right, that can use these Quest, the services we purchase, to provide any telecommunication service. And it's not uncommon for ULEC. We can provide DOT if someone orders one. We have it tariffed MCI, Metro Access Transmission Services, which is identified several times in their testimony as a similarly situated ULEC, also has it in their South Dakota tariff that you can purchase a DOT. So we are not Quest, and just as I'm not CFO of Verizon, Orbitcom is not Quest. If it was, we wouldn't be here today.
Mr. Powers, has Orbitcom ever received an access service request or ASR from Verizon for a DOT?
No, we have not.
In this particular case, is there any reason why Orbitcom cannot then bill Verizon for the tandem switching element it has?
No, there's not. The Verizon's calls have to get to and from Orbitcom's end users somehow. And if they don't have a DOT to us, it has to go through the tandem. And I don't think there's any complaints here that they aren't getting their calls originated or terminated, even though they haven't paid for that service for some time. While they're speaking, I might speak to that a little bit, in that under the tariff system, it makes it very difficult to, the reason people are supposed to pay on time is because you have to give the service. And if we don't get paid, eventually we can't give the service, and the system starts to break down. So the prompt paying of access charges is an important component of it. I don't think the commission would be happier if I came and said I would like you to, I'd like not to have to deliver the calls anymore. And our customers would not be happy. It's almost an unworkable situation where we're trapped into giving service whether we're getting paid or not.
Mr. Powers, I'd like to clarify one issue with regard to the DDoT. When you speak of Orbitcom's agreement with Quest, specifically the QLSP, if Quest is billing for traffic that includes all of the elements, is Orbitcom able to bill for that?
If Quest is billing for traffic, including all the elements, yes. Well, not the same telephone call. The way it works is this. If Orbitcom is billing for it, Quest cannot. And if it is a any that belongs to Orbitcom, an end user's telephone number of an end user of an Orbitcom customer, Quest cannot or will not bill access on that any. That the right to bill that access belongs exclusively to Orbitcom.
Mr. Powers, as you sit here today, can you tell the commission the amount of money that you believe Verizon owes to Orbitcom?
I can. And once again, I must use my notes. Have we submitted those bills, those face pages this morning?
We have.
We have submitted invoices. These are invoices that have been submitted to Verizon and have gone unpaid. If partial payment has been made, that has been applied. This is the unpaid balance of our invoices to Verizon. The ones we've submitted will total $716,149. Out of that, that is for both interstate and intrastate services rendered under those billing account numbers. We're not asking this commission to do anything about the interstate charges. So the amount that Verizon owes Orbitcom is $686,147 for intrastate services in South Dakota under our South Dakota tariff.
Thank you, Mr. Powers. We would tender the witness for cross-examination.
Ms. Moore, could you identify the exhibit number of what he was just referencing just for the transcript?
Certainly. Mr. Powers was just referencing what we have marked as Exhibit 4. And just for the commission's reference as well, that was originally included with Mr. Powers' rebuttal testimony as Exhibit MP20, and what we have done to make it somewhat more manageable is to submit only the face pages for those particular bills as opposed to all of the call detail that accompanied the bills.
Thank you. Does that conclude your direct examination then, Ms. Moore?
It does, Mr. Smith, and we would tender Mr. Powers for cross-examination.
Mr. Dixon, are you ready to go here?
Well, Mr. Smith, some of this stuff we've received just this morning and have not had an opportunity to review it with my witness. Could we take a brief recess?
I think probably a lot of us would just soon have a brief recess. What do you think? How much? 15 minutes? Is that sufficient?
If that's acceptable to Commission, 15 minutes.
Are you guys okay with that, Commissioners? Okay, why don't we take a 15 so you can review what you've just been shown. Thank you. We'll be in recess until 11:15. Back in session after a brief recess, a couple minutes after, a quarter after. Mr. Dixon, it was time for you to begin your cross-examination. Are you prepared to go?
I'm prepared to go forward. Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Morris.
It's last we meet.
Thank you.
Mike?
Oh, I thought I had it on. The light's on.
Okay, there you go. You got to keep the ball pretty close to your mouth, I'll tell you.
Is that working better?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Mr. Powers, like you indicated in your testimony, I want to focus on the real issues that you start talking about in your rebuttal testimony on page 17. So do you have your testimony in front of you?
I don't.
You do not? Can we have the witness have a copy of his testimony? I'll need both in front of them. I don't think I'll need the direct, but if I do, I'll ask for it.
So the rebuttal or the supplemental rebuttal?
Rebuttal.
All right, I have it.
And I'm looking at page 17, which starts with the question, I would now like to turn to the real issues in this matter, which is what you basically described in your summary this morning. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Orbicom's intrastate tariff provides, as you've indicated, three methods for determining the jurisdiction of a call. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And you already generally referenced the first method is to use the actual call data, which you've referred to as jurisdictional billing. That is also correct.
That is the first one listed under that section, I believe.
In your testimony here as well. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. And you indicated on your summary you first began using jurisdictional billing, the first method that you've described in your testimony, in May of 2009. Am I correct?
That is correct.
And then prior to then, again, you've indicated that you relied on what's referred to as the second method that you describe on line 7 of page 17. Is that correct? And maybe to clarify, that's a PIU, a percentage of intrastate usage, that the company determines.
Yes, I just had to read it before I agreed with it.
That's correct. And you've used a company-determined percentage of intrastate use from June of 2007 through April of 2009. Am I correct?
In this case, we used what is actually the default method of we used the default PIU of 32%.
All right, and you used that from June of 2007 to April of 2009?
Other than the period where we had it set at 5% percentage of interstate use, yes.
And so that's when you talk about you use the default method, you're referring to, in this case, the second method you described on your testimony, which is allowed by your tariff, according to your testimony, to use a percentage of interstate usage developed by the company.
I don't believe that's quite accurate. I would have to get the testimony in front of me. But there's actually what I probably would describe a fourth method where we apply a default PIU. All of the carriers have that at the end of their tariff. In the event of none of these, so to speak, the traffic will be billed at X percentage of interstate use.
All right. Well, what I'm trying to get at is, as I understand, and I'm looking at your testimony, your rebuttal testimony here, you make the statement, you state that there is a second on line 7, of page 17. The second method allowed by the tariff is to use a PIU developed by the company, in this case, Orbitcom. This is the method Orbitcom used to with Verizon and others prior to April of 2009. I'm just asking you if that's correct. That's what happened from June 7 prior to April of 2009. Am I right?
Yeah, I see what you're saying. And It just so happens that the second method results in the default PIU unless we apply it specifically to some other company. So it says what it says.
Thank you. And then the third method that's described on your testimony, which begins on line 9, is to use a percentage of interstate use factor provided by the customer. In this case, that would be Verizon. Is that correct?
Correct.
And just to make it clear for the record, Orbicom never used a percentage of interstate use factor provided by Verizon.
Just to make it clear, Verizon did not provide one until quite a ways into these proceedings. It's in the testimony and the exhibits as to when they produced one and then one that applied retroactively.
But the point I'm getting at is, regardless of when it was provided, and I think your testimony will show it was August of 2008, you did not, that is, Orbicom did not apply that percentage of interstate use, the third method that's specifically authorized in the tariff. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Thank you. You've also stated in your testimony, when asked who chooses the alternative method to use on line 12 and 13, you state in line 14, Orbicom applies its own tariff. And later in your testimony goes on to say that Orbicom actually chooses which of the three methods will be applied. Is that correct?
I agree with that. Line 14 says the company, that is Orbicom, applies its own tariff. When you say later on, where is that you're referring to?
Please look at page 20 of your rebuttal testimony, and I would direct you to the first question and answer. And in particular, I direct you to the sentence that begins on line 3, which I'll read to you. Again, the method of determining the PIU is the decision of the company, hyphen, Orbicom, not the customer. Now, that's correct, is it not?
That's what it says, yes.
And that's correct. That's a correct statement. You're not changing that testimony.
No, I am not.
You've also testified, and I'm focusing on page 18, beginning on line, in the area of line 18 through 22, that Orbicom changed its tariff in March of 2007 to allow for jurisdictional billing. That's correct, is it not?
Yes, that's what I've said.
And just so it's clear for the record, when you say, yes, that's what I said, you're not suggesting something other than that's a correct answer.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
Okay. And you also state on line 22 that, however, Orbicom's billing company could not implement jurisdictional billing to Orbicom's satisfaction. That's correct also?
Yes.
And then you ultimately state that you stopped using that billing company in March of 2009.
And ultimately, where did I state that?
If we can look at, I'll pull the exhibit. It's LF10, which is not your exhibit.
Pardon me, Tom. I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just reluctant to agree with the statement when I don't have it in front of me as to whether I said it or it is my position.
I understand. I just need to pull the exhibit. May I approach the witness?
You may.
If I may kind of be over him so I can use the microphone. Is that
appropriate? Yeah, you might want to bring it up there. Unfortunately, we don't have a wireless mic in this room, and that's unfortunate.
I'm going to direct your attention to what's been, what I will identify as Verizon, a response to Verizon data request number 51, where the question is, state whether Orbicom is still using a third-party billing company, and if the response is other than yes, please state when Orbicom ceased using that billing company, and it states March of 2009. Do you see that?
Yes, I do.
And is that answer correct?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
I should say it is within reason because it's a process to switch billing companies if you've ever been involved in it.
Right. But my question was, and based on that data request response, you stopped using that billing company in March of 2009. That's correct.
Yep. That we quit using them as a service bureau, yes.
Thank you. Now, prior to that date, Orbicom was unable to bill jurisdictionally until April of 2009. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if you look at page 18, line 14, I think that's where you indicated, again, that's page 18, line 14. This is where you indicated the tariff writer, and I quote, got a little ahead of the curve, end quote, and recommended jurisdictional billing. That's correct.
Yes, that's correct.
And you actually implemented his suggestion by filing with the commission on March 7, 2007, revised page 21 of your tariff, and that became effective on its page on March 21, 2007. Is that correct? And if you want to, you can refer to your tariff that was attached to your supplemental testimony.
Yeah, I would like to clarify what you mean by when you said we implemented his suggestion in that we alter our tariff or we filed a new pages in our tariff on this section. Is that what you mean by implemented?
That you what I'm focusing on is that you actually included language for jurisdictional billing in your tariff in March of 2007, and that's reflected on MP Exhibit 217 to your rebuttal testimony, if you wish to look at it.
Yes, that sounds correct, yes.
And that exhibit speaks for itself, but it is attached to your testimony. And I think you should turn to that exhibit, if you would. It's, as I indicated, it's MP2-17. And once you're there, I would suggest you look at paragraph or section 3.4 and review it to yourself for a moment. We'll talk about it a little bit after that. When you finish,
am I looking for our tariff, Tom?
Yes, you're looking for the Orbicom tariff, and it's if I can approach the witness, I will show you perhaps in your testimony if you can't find it. Or let me do this. Did you find it?
I believe I did. I have MP216. I'm looking for 17.
I could approach the witness with
please feel free to do that. And you may do that without permission every time. Right.
Sure.
Your Honor, I have just provided the witness. What I'll represent is first revised page number 21 to the Orbicom tariff, issued March 7, 2007, and effective March 21, 2007, which is part of Exhibit 2. It is one of the exhibits that have been admitted into evidence. Do you have that document in front of you now?
Yeah, I do.
All right. And I asked you to focus on Section 3.4. Have you had a chance to read it? And if not, please take your time.
Okay.
Thank you. Would you agree with me that the first sentence of Section 3.4 in Exhibit 2, MP2-17, addresses jurisdictional billing and the requirements that the company to use jurisdictional billing under certain circumstances?
It says what it says.
All right, why don't you read the first sentence into the record out loud?
When the company receives sufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of some or all originating and terminating access minutes of use, MOU, the company will use that call detail to render bills for those MOU, meaning minutes of use, and will not use PIU factors.
All right. Thank you. And that tariff became effective on March 21 of 2007, correct?
Correct.
Right. Now, you've already testified that, in fact, Orbitcom did not use jurisdictional billing until May of 2009. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that sentence specifically precludes and in fact prohibits Orbitcom from using a PIU factor when it receives sufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of some or all of the terminating and access minutes of use. Is that correct?
No, I don't agree with that at all.
Would you please look at the last clause of the first sentence you just read into the record, and I'll read to you. It says, and will not use PIU factors. Are you denying that's what the tariff says?
Maybe you better rephrase the conclusion you're asking me to draw there.
Saying that under the first sentence, if Orbicom receives sufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of some or all of its originating access minutes of use, the company will not use PIU factors and instead will rely on the call detail to render billing. Is that not what it says?
Yeah. The point, it wasn't worded perfectly, but I understand. If we're going to use jurisdiction, we're not going to use a PIU. If we can bill by jurisdiction, we're not going to use a PIU. That is correct.
Thank you. And we'll stick with this section for just a moment. With regard to the second and third methods that you've discussed, the second being the company determining a percentage of interstate use, the third being the customer determining a percentage of interstate use, that will only apply those factors in the event there is insufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of a call. Is that correct? Under the tariff.
The tariff says what it says.
And that's what it says, is it not?
Yes, that's what it says.
So can you tell me where in the tariff it states that Orbitcom can choose one of three methods to bill access minutes for originating and terminating minutes of use, that you choose the three methods?
What it says is that we will use jurisdiction, we will bill by jurisdiction if possible. And I've explained the disconnect between the tariff and the Orbitcom reality during that period, in that we filed this tariff, but the billing company was not able to implement jurisdictional billing with any degree of, reliability.
All right. Let's just turn to your supplemental rebuttal testimony now, the next version. And I'd like you to turn to page 3. And when you're there, I would suggest you read, in preparation for my questions, the material that begins on line 6 and concludes with just before the partial last sentence on line 23, just to review it to yourself before we start talking about it.
Okay, I've read it.
All right. Thank you very much. If you need time to look at it again, please feel free to do so. Generally, this describes the difference between what are known as call detail records, or CDRs, and EMI records. Am I correct?
That's my explanation, yes.
All right. And in your testimony, particularly around line 19, you state that EMI records are created by Quest and are sent to Orbitcom, or in prior case, your billing agent. Is that correct?
There's a sentence there that says something, and it says what it says. You're not reading it correctly, so what do you want me to agree to?
I'm saying you're in your testimony said that these records are sent by Quest to Orbitcom. Is that correct?
Are you referring to line 17 again?
Just a moment. I'm in 19 initially, and I'm also looking at just this discussion. Give me just a moment. I have this marked. Right, I'm sorry. It is. I had it marked. I didn't see it. Please look at line 15 at the beginning. And I'm sorry. I actually added two thoughts in different lines together, and I apologize. At line 15, you say you're talking about the difference between EMI formatted records sent to Orbitcom by Quest. So that was the point of my question, that these EMI records are created by Quest and sent to Orbitcom.
Correct.
And in your case, based on a data response, it was actually being sent to your billing agent. Am I correct? And I'm talking now back in 2007 through March of 2009 when you indicated you stopped using your billing agent.
The way they are sent to, and I'm not clear on the process, they are sent to like an FTP site where the billing agent or someone authorized can then extract them from there. So I don't like to email them to you or anything. They put them to a site where you can retrieve them.
Right. As you've kind of indicated in your summary, these are pretty voluminous records,
yes.
Correct? And so what you're telling me, though, is the EMI records are sent to a site. I think you said FPC?
FTP site, I think. They
you
call
have
it
a
file transfer protocol or something like that.
Thank you. And then your billing agent from June of 07 through March of 09 would go to that site and extract data to prepare bills on behalf of Orbitcom that it sent to Verizon. Is that correct?
Either the billing agent did it or we did it for them. There's a number of files that come that way. I think we get 9 each day, plus we get some other files, and I'm not sure what the process was. But that's essentially correct. The billing agent ended up with them.
And if we look to page 4, and specifically line 10, the EMI records that are provided to the FTPC and are accessible by either your billing agent or Orbitcom are identified as category 11-01-01 and 11-01-25 records, which are used for access billing. Is that correct?
Yes.
And since June of 2007 to the present, Orbitcom or its billing agent has received or had access to, through the FTPC, Quest EMI records in order to bill Verizon for services. Is that correct?
The calls are sent to an FTP site for retrieval.
And so my point is once they get to that site, as you indicated, both Orbitcom or its billing agent have access to that site to extract data to prepare bills for Verizon.
They have access to transfer the files from there to the billing system.
And from that site, then indeed Orbitcom creates a bill using those records, correct?
Correct.
All right. And you've already indicated in your testimony, but on page 4, lines 16 and 19, the EMI records provide Orbitcom or its billing agent with sufficient call detail to know the jurisdiction of long-distance calls. That's correct.
It provided us with it, yes.
Yes, provided you or your billing agent.
But not the software.
I understand. And you've also indicated, we've talked a little bit about call detail records. Call detail records are records that Orbitcom or its billing agent creates, if desired, from the EMI records that are provided by Quest. Is that correct? And I'm referring to page 5, line 1.
It's essentially correct. That's not exactly the process, but that's essentially correct.
And this is the process you described that takes a time to create these call detail records from the EMI formatted records. Is that correct?
It doesn't work that way, no. It's I said how it works. It strips the information it needs. It does not actually create call detail reports. It doesn't need to sort these raw records into what we know as call detail records that say the phone number and the time and records that we're used to seeing in relation to phone companies. It just strips the pertinent data, leaves the record there.
Right, and I'm not taking issue with that.
And then when you want CDRs, it has to actually go back and pull each record and put it in that format. So that's the process.
And that was my point. It's not that they're automatically created. You have to create CDRs, call detail records, using the EMI records that Quest provides you.
No, now we're using the data that the billing system, once it's extracted that data, now it has to go back, pick up that record. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but it's working backwards now from the data that it used to create the bill.
And on line 6 of page 5, you go on to state, once the CDRs are extracted, they provide the underlying detail of the data used to generate an access bill. Is that correct?
I think that would have been better worded if it said they show the underlying detail of the data. They really don't provide the underlying data used to generate an access bill. They show what that data was.
You will agree with me, and I think you stated it in your summary, that Verizon requested CDRs from Orbitcom in February of 2008.
I believe that's true.
Okay. And in fact, I think you stated in your testimony that's when, in your summary this morning, that's when, from your perspective, Verizon provided you with a dispute.
That's correct.
And you will agree with me, and I can direct you to the exhibits that are attached to Ms. Freet's testimony, that Verizon requested from Orbitcom call detail records or sufficient call detail data prior to this complaint being filed against Verizon on or about September of 2008. That indeed Verizon had requested on several, numerous, whatever adjective you want to use, the exhibits speak for themselves. That's correct.
Whatever the exhibits say, I will agree with, yes.
All right. And I would suggest for the record, and if you wish, I'll bring them to you, Ms. Freet's exhibit LF-3, LF-6, and LF-12, all are requests for CDR records that are already in evidence in the record.
Meredith, is that accurate?
I can bring them to you, or you can do it subject to check.
Yeah.
Sure.
I don't like doing anything subject to check.
Fine. I'm happy to do that. I'm trying to figure out where my Leslie's testimony is. All these notebooks, I lost one for a minute. Well,
First, I'll show you LF3, and I will, I've got a portion highlighted. Would you read the next to the last paragraph before the highlighted portion to yourself?
Okay.
That was the request for call detail records made by Verizon on February 19th of 2008 to Penny Peterson. Is that correct?
Correct.
And Penny Peterson is an employee of Orbitcom.
Yes, she is.
In fact, she was, as you've indicated in your testimony, actively involved in this dispute.
Yes.
And would you take a look at LF6, exhibit LF6, and just read the last sentence to yourself? And you would agree with me that is a request for a 3-day sample of call detail records for the 555 and 222 June 2008 invoices. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that, again, is a communication between Verizon and Penny Peterson on July 11th, 2008.
Correct.
Mr. Powers, could I have you move the mic a little that way? We're not picking this up very well. Thank you. Thanks.
You picking me up all right?
Well, probably not, but there are certain practical limits we'll just have to live with. But
I apologize.
Okay, that's fine.
We'll be buddies together at one point. Also, I referenced Exhibit LF-12, and again, I'll refer you to the last sentence in Exhibit LF-12, and if you read it to yourself. And once again, that is an exhibit where Verizon requests call detail records from Orbitcom on February 14th of 2008. Is that correct?
Yeah, it looks like it's a follow-up request for the same CDRs they'd asked for before.
Thank you. So we've established, after you've looked at these exhibits, that indeed Verizon requested call detail records in February of 2008 and subsequently on at least two occasions.
Yes.
Verizon did not provide those call detail records to Verizon prior to filing this complaint. Is that correct? I'm sorry. Let me restate that. Thank you. Orbitcom did not provide any call detail records to Verizon prior to filing this complaint on or about September of 2008. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And in fact, it was Orbitcom's practice prior to filing this complaint not to save or retain EMI records or EMI formatted records or anything which you had extracted from the FTPC site as a policy, is that correct?
It was apparently the billing company's policy.
And okay, and it was the billing company that worked for Orbitcom, nevertheless, am I correct?
They didn't work that hard for us, but we used their services, yes.
And in fact, you did not instruct the billing company to retain call detail records or EMI formatted data that was available to it for preparing your bills at any time, is that correct? And this is prior to the complaint, so I'm sorry to not be clear.
That sounds correct. I'm a little vague on the time frames and all that, but I will, whatever it says here, I will agree with.
I'm going to hold it because I want you to be comfortable. I don't want you to be speculating. identification, an excerpt from Orbicom's objections and responses to Verizon's third set of discovery requests. In particular, in the middle of that document, it is entitled Orbicom's Responses to Verizon Data Requests 71 and 72. Ms. Moore has brought to my attention that she would like, since the exhibit, this document makes a reference to another data request, that that also be made part of the record. I'll subsequently, after lunch or later on, add data request, the response to data request 70, which is also referenced in this document. So just so for identification.
Will this exhibit include that 70 in the response then?
If that's acceptable, we'll just substitute a new exhibit E, which mm-hmm. will be the include the response to data request 70, if that's acceptable to Ms. Moore.
And I'm currently reviewing what the actual response says, so if I can have a moment, please.
Sure.
Agreed will include Exhibit 70, or the response to data request number 70, and I have provided that to, or will provide that to Mr. Powers now.
Is that your understanding, Ms. Moore?
That's a fair statement, Mr. Scott.
Okay, thank you.
I've read it.
You've read the response to 70. Have you also read the responses to 71 and 72, which was the other document I put in front of you and has been marked as Exhibit E?
There's no response to 72 on here, I don't believe. There is no response. It says none.
That is a response.
I understand.
Is it not?
I understand.
We won't quibble. What we will do is create a new Exhibit E. That's what Ms. Moore has requested, which will include both the response to 70 as well as 71 and 72, and we'll substitute that for the one I actually had initially marked as Exhibit E to address her concerns. Is that acceptable?
That's acceptable. Thank you, Mr. Dixon.
Mr. Smith?
Yes.
Thank you. And so my question had been, so we get back to where I was, and I will return to my chair in just a moment. We had established that prior to filing this complaint, Orbicom nor its billing agent were retaining call detail records or the call detail or even the EMI records. And you said, yes, that was correct. And the point I raised here was, you said you thought that was correct, and then I showed you this Exhibit E. And you will agree that this Exhibit E states in response to the questions for question 71, produce all communications between Orbicom and its third-party billing vendor or vendors during the period from January of 2008 through July 2009 concerning the retention of call detail records and other information used to produce invoices issued to Verizon, and the response is none. Is that correct?
Yes.
And similarly, on question 72, it is a similar question, and again, we can all read it. The answer is none in terms of any correspondence, memoranda, or other documents that Orbicon directed to its billing agent to retain records. Is that correct?
Correct. It says none.
Mr. Smith, I'm about probably halfway through my questions.
Okay.
I know you mentioned a lunch, maybe around noon.
Mm-hmm.
It is noon. I'm perfectly willing to go on or stop whenever you would like at this point.
Are there opinions from commissioners, our court reporter, others about what you'd like to do in terms of lunch?
How much longer do you expect, Mr. Dixon? It'd be nice to finish up at least one witness before we break for lunch.
I can keep going, at least for the time being, then.
Okay. I mean, if it's going to be another 2 hours, obviously we're going to take a lunch.
I hope not. I have, as I said, I'm about halfway through the questions I had prepared.
Thank you. Why don't we proceed and see if we can get this done, then.
I don't know if you wanted the court reporter to have a recess at any point either for the purpose.
Yep. Okay. She looks like she's fine. Let's proceed.
Thank you. And if I haven't specifically stated, I would move for the admission of Exhibit E as it will be modified to include the responses to data requests 70, 71, and 72, and we'll provide that as a late-filed exhibit.
Okay. Verizon Exhibit E has been offered. Is there objection?
No objection to the extent that Mr. Dixon presents the whole of the exhibit, which we discussed.
Mm-hmm. Staff? Hearing none, Exhibit E, Verizon Exhibit E is admitted.
Thank you. Just trying to go and see if I can eliminate some of the questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
We've already established that Orbitcom at least began ceasing to use its billing agent on March of 2009, as the discovery request indicated the response, correct?
Yes.
How long does, if I said Verizon, I apologize, that Orbitcom has stopped using its billing agent since on or about March of 2009? To clarify my question, is that correct?
Yes.
How long does Orbitcom retain call detail records and EMI records since it became its own billing agent, or does the billing itself?
I cannot say for certain. I would say it is my understanding that we have retained all of them so far.
What is the company's policy about retaining billing records, if any?
On the retail side, there are certain requirements for CALEA and other agencies, and so we keep the records that we bill customers, long distance calls or other things, I believe are kept somewhat longer to comply with those issues.
All right, but I don't want to focus on retail customers. I don't want to cut you off, but I don't think that's my issue, and I apologize if it's not clear. I'm talking how long does Orbitcom or any billing agents it uses, if any now, retain call detail records, EMI formatted records that they've extracted from the FTPC for purposes of maintaining billing data, if any? What time period?
our policy right now is to keep them till we're sure we no longer need them. And that is, we haven't established a date, but we, before we discard any, we will know, that it's the proper time to do so. I will say that, only for the call detail records that comprise the bill. That's what we bill people, and that is what we feel we would produce for them, or we should produce for them, not raw data, in any form, actually. We may keep that too, I don't know, but our policy will be to keep the what we now know as CDRs, or at least the material there to create them.
So what I'm hearing is you had no such policy prior, perhaps, to this lawsuit or this case being started, and even as of today. And you're creating a policy on a going-forward basis.
When you say that, we haven't thrown any away. So our policy at this point is to keep them forever. How's that?
That's excellent, going forward. That was not the policy you implemented with the company when in 2008 when Verizon was seeking call detail records from Orbitcom. Is that correct?
We had no policy. We were just going along with the what the other company was doing. So
the billing agent, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, and so you allowed the billing agent to purge records as they chose to do so. Is that correct?
Objection. That's argumentative and a misstatement of the witness's previous testimony.
Sustained.
You've indicated you did not provide any instructions to the billing company to retain call detail records prior to the filing of this complaint. Is that correct?
Yes.
And I can direct you to a data request where you, Penny Peterson, stated the billing company purges the records, and that's why they were not available when requested by Verizon in 2008, February, and in July of 2008, prior to the filing of the complaint. Do you need to see that, or do you recall that?
I would agree with it.
And Penny Peterson stated that.
Yes, I would agree with that.
In retrospect, you would agree with me now you should have maintained those records consistent with your new policy to retain these billing records forever because of possible billing disputes. Is that correct?
Not necessarily. I would like to complete that statement, though.
I'll let you because she'll do it on redirect, so go for it.
One of the contentions we've had here, Tom, as you well know, is that we did not consider Verizon's disputes valid because of the lack of information. And so it was kind of had we received a formal notice of a dispute that we considered valid, or after we denied them, had Verizon appealed to an administrative body, we would then have viewed that as an active dispute, and in fact we now have a policy that in that event that we circulate a memo saying don't destroy any records, even emails or whatnot, relating to such and such an issue because of a possible legal action.
If I can have just a moment, I want to go back to some testimony. Mr. Powers, then what you're basically saying is that you didn't think Verizon was disputing the billing records of the company when it asked for those records, both in emails and otherwise, in 2008?
I don't think. I'm saying we did not consider their dispute valid because of their refusal to provide information that we needed to investigate it.
And what information did they not provide that you didn't understand?
I believe it's outlined in our testimony, but we need, at a minimum, the number of minutes involved. If we can start with the band number, the billing account number, the billing period, the minutes involved, the rate that they're disputing, the rate that they think it should be. And they can't be all mixed together. We can't investigate it. And so that's basic information. We don't, we're not rigid about it, but we need something to investigate.
You understood, however, that Verizon was challenging how you were jurisdictionalizing traffic at least from February 08 forward. Am I correct?
No, I can't agree with that.
And you understood that Verizon was asking for call detail records, and you did not retain them. Is that correct during that period of time?
I believe they were asking for records that had already been disposed of, is what I understand.
Where did my questions go? The first time that Orbitcom produced call detail records and ultimately EMI records in an Excel spreadsheet was after the motion to compel was granted. Am I correct? I'm talking in Excel format.
The first time we could produce complete records in Excel format was after the motion was granted, correct?
Prior to that, you had submitted several days before, some samples of 3 days of CDRs that were on a PDF file. Am I correct?
I believe that's how they were, yes.
Right. And that was in response to data request 48, and ultimately that's where the commission ordered you to provide files that could be, so to speak, manipulated and reviewed. Am I correct?
Correct.
Apparently, on August 31st, and I refer you to your testimony, you indicated at that point you voluntarily realized that you could obtain EMI records because you had a programmer isolate the Verizon records from other carriers. Am I correct?
Say again what I voluntarily did.
August 31st, you offered to actually, it may have been through your attorney, that Orbitcom offered to voluntarily provide EMI records to Verizon. And I think, to help you out, you have an exhibit that actually does this. And it's exhibit MP3-28 in your supplemental rebuttal testimony. And I'm referring to that letter in your offer.
This is the one I had our attorney... I wrote and had our attorney forward to you, Tom.
Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Thank you.
And it includes the article and about our concerns about the CPNI information.
I understand. But that is the letter I'm talking about. That's when you were able to turn around and provide us EMI records. Am I correct?
Yes.
Relevant to this case, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Thank you. I'd also like you to take a look at MP2-18. This is attached to your rebuttal testimony, and it's right after the tariff page, so that you had some trouble locating.
The original rebuttal testimony. All right. Kind of tricky. Some of them are rather thick, and some of them are only a page. So,
I agree. I've had some of the same issues.
This comes right after Orbitcom South Dakota tariff. Did you say?
Yes.
All right. Should be close. All right. This one?
That is correct. In your rebuttal testimony on page 18, if you want to also turn to that. Line 9. Have you read that?
Yes.
All right. You generally describe another method you use to validate, from Orbitcom's perspective, a 32% percentage of interstate usage by relying on a bill from your underlying major provider. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Who was that underlying major provider?
I believe we answered that in our data request, didn't we?
You headed me right to it. Thank you. I have a document I want to have marked as Exhibit F. My understanding, this exhibit has been marked for identification as Exhibit F. Am I correct? Mr. Powers, do you have a copy of that document in front of you?
No. I have this one. I don't have Exhibit F.
Thank you. Let me know when you finish reading it.
I have.
You alluded to, in response to a question about who was the major long-distance provider you were referring to in your testimony, you thought you answered that in the data request. Is Exhibit F the data request to which you were responding or referencing?
There's two questions. I alluded to something, and is this the exhibit? So I'll answer the second one first. This is the exhibit.
That you were referring to.
Yes.
Thank you. And my question was the long-distance, the major supplier of long-distance services that you were referring to, who was that? And you said you thought it was Global Crossing. Is that what this data request also confirms? I look under F toward the bottom.
Mm. It doesn't say I thought anything. It says Global Crossing.
You have to tie it to the question. Please read question F.
Name the supplier of long-distance services that issued the bill referenced in Mr. Powers' rebuttal testimony on page 18, lines 9 and 10.
And your response to F is?
Global Crossing.
Thank you. With respect to the data that's on MP2 dash, I believe that's, let me just check the number, 18. Would you read question G into the record? It's very short.
Please state the date on which the bill in Exhibit MP-18 was issued.
And the answer under section G is what?
January and February of 2004. I'm
going to move for the admission of Exhibit F.
No objection.
Staff.
No objection.
Exhibit F is admitted.
Just for the record, that document is identified as a response to data request, Verizon data request number 73. if you'll take a look at Exhibit F, and in particular if you would focus on question H, which asks you generally, or asks Orbicom generally, does the traffic identified on Exhibit MP2-18 relate only to traffic that was originated or terminated in South Dakota? And the answer on H, responding to that, is no. Am I correct?
That's correct.
What states were included on the traffic on Exhibit MP2-18 to come up with the data and the volumes that are identified on Exhibit MP2-18? What other states were included?
I'll only be giving you, I'll be working from memory here, because obviously it doesn't state that.
I realize that. It says it isn't solely South Dakota. I'm simply asking the flip. What states were included?
Yes. And I can tell you I cannot give you a precise answer, but I'll give you the best answer I can.
That's all I can ask for. You're under oath, and I'm sure you'll do your best.
When we began operations, we focused mainly in South Dakota. The next point where we started marketing was in Nebraska and North Dakota. And I would say South Dakota would be more than half, and the rest would be those other two states. And again, I'm working from memory.
With that understanding, and let's use your number, and I'm not going to announce this is confidential data for Orbicom, am I correct? This document, you haven't identified with your rebuttal as an exhibit, and then in your SIR rebuttal, you identified it as confidential. So I want to make sure, is it confidential or not?
There was an additional item, I think, in the SIR rebuttal. What you're working off of here is not.
Oh, good. So we'll do a little math in our head. Hopefully it won't tax either of us. But as I look at the usage charges, and more particularly the volume, I'm going to focus on, again, on Exhibit MP2-18, where it talks about ACC, direct switched outbound interstate, and under that, ACC, direct switched outbound intrastate. So the first was INTER, second is INTRA. And then further down, ACC, direct switched inbound interstate, and ACC, direct switched inbound intrastate. Do you see those quantities in the first column?
I do.
Would you agree with me that if you added those four figures, they make up the majority of the traffic on this exhibit on that first column, am I correct?
That would be correct.
And if I added those up, they roughly come to a total of 209,000 minutes, and you can take a minute to do that if you wish. It speaks for itself. But I don't want to put words. Is that what you would get, roughly 2,000?
That's roughly correct, yes.
And from what you've testified, half of that might be South Dakota traffic. Am I right?
It's an estimate based on 5 years of gold memory of a rather obscure document.
Right. I understand. But you put it into evidence, and I'm just looking at it for
sure.
What it says. If you look at the second column, I'd represent adding those same figures. If you added those two together, and I have to do my math now.
You're looking roughly 200,000 minutes in the second column as well.
I was going to say that it was roughly that, slightly under 200,000. And again, roughly half of that would be South Dakota traffic.
Yeah, it's my best estimate. What I put into evidence, Tom, is what it says here.
I understand.
And what you're asking me, you're taking your chances.
I'm establishing a foundation because I now want you to move to your next exhibit, which is Exhibit MP2-19. And this one has confidential data on it, and I will not refer to the data by numbers, and I would ask Mr. Powers not to refer to the numbers either. We can talk in terms of percentages.
I have it.
Actually, I'm going to drop this line. We'll just stop at it. I think we're done with this at this point. Let's go back to your, well, I'm going to remind you in your supplemental rebuttal testimony again on page. I believe it's 9, but I want to confirm. Yes, it's on page 10, I'm sorry, of your supplemental rebuttal testimony, and I would refer you to lines 11 and 12.
Make sure I got the right one.
This is just in your testimony, not...
He says a supplemental rebuttal testimony,
supplemental
the last
rebuttal
one filed?
Testimony. Yes, page 10.
Give me a minute to find it. I've been shuffling paper up there the whole time, so.
Do you know what exhibit number it is, or you actually have the testimony, Mr. Powers?
Yeah, I have both testimony. I have my rebuttal testimony and my supplemental rebuttal testimony.
Your supplemental rebuttal is exhibit 3.
Yeah, I'm just. They seem to have gotten mixed together, Karen.
Can I approach the witness?
That happens to me all the time, by the way.
I can use my copy and direct his attention. It's only a couple lines.
Yes, please approach.
And I directed your attentions to line, I said 11 and 12, but it actually starts on 10 and runs through 14.
Sure.
You have a copy that I provided you to look at, am I correct?
Yes.
All right. You indicated that Verizon does not produce any source documents, like an EMI/DUF that Orbicom has produced for its records. First of all, let me see if I understand what you're talking about. From your summary, I assume you're talking about Exhibit 30, Confidential Exhibit 37, which is the one from which you extracted and created, I believe it was Exhibit 5.
I didn't extract anything. I resorted it.
I resorted it. I didn't mean to. I'm not trying to make tricky with the word. I'm sorry. But I'm trying to say that's the exhibit that you're referring to, Exhibit 37, from which you resorted data and created an Exhibit 5. Am I correct?
Well, which line are you referring to here? The 10 and 11, did you say?
Yeah, beginning on line 10, you say, I cannot confirm that, and it goes on, that sentence I'm referring to.
Is there a complete question I'm supposed to answer at this point? If there is, you're going to have to rephrase it for me.
I'm just asking you first to read that area, and then I'll get to it. I want to make sure the question was, when you talk about we did not provide source data to Verizon Switch records, I'm asking you if the records to which you are referring was the confidential Exhibit 37, which is the long confidential exhibit that was sent to you, from which you also created an Exhibit 5.
I'm not sure we can draw the inference of what records I'm referring to, because I was referring that this is, I cannot confirm the Verizon Switch records, as Verizon has not produced any source documents, like an EMI DUF that Orbicom has produced for its record, that supports this spreadsheet. So I guess we're saying that, I believe that we're, what I'm saying, and I have to read the whole thing, I believe what I'm saying is that LF37 contains the records that support a whole number
of other exhibits, and one of them is apparently this spreadsheet. Is that where we're getting at?
I think we are. This is a simple question. I was just trying to make sure the switch records you're referring to have been admitted into evidence as Exhibit 37, which is – that's all I'm trying to get to. So it's clear what records you're referring to.
Yeah, the records that support a spreadsheet, but I'm not sure which one I am. But obviously, the switch records contained in LF-37 have been admitted into the record, if that's what you're getting to.
I think we'll – this horse has probably died.
I have to read the whole thing to see how we got to this point where I'm referring to a certain spreadsheet. That's all.
I understand. That was my point. I was trying to determine what spreadsheet you were referring to that you referred to as Verizon switch records, or which of several spreadsheets it could be.
I wasn't referring to a spreadsheet as Verizon switch records. I was referring to a spreadsheet as a summary and conclusions that were drawn, an exhibit that was created.
Let me say, if I can make this easy, regardless of which records you were referring to, did you send any data requests to Verizon for source documents for records that were produced to you on October 5th in the testimony?
I'm not sure. I'll defer to the attorneys. So,
can we stipulate there are no requests for any underlying source documents to the records produced as part of the supplemental rebuttal testimony? To use the broadest term, records.
I think our problem is that we're using the term records, spreadsheets, and we're far afield from what ultimately was discussed. We sent two sets of data requests. I'm willing to agree to that. And we sent the second set, which did request some source documents, after the testimony was filed. So I agree to that.
Would you agree with me, Meredith, though, that the second set of data requests did not ask for any underlying documents for the records he was referring to in this passage?
I won't agree with that, because that's what I think was encompassed in DR1 of that second set of data requests.
I think we'd like to make a copy of the data requests then, that are the second set, to demonstrate what I'm trying to ask the witness, and we don't seem to be able to get anyone to agree.
Are we then at a point where we break for lunch?
I think that'd be a good idea, Mr. Smith.
Okay. In terms of time, what do you guys want? Say an hour and 15 minutes. How is that? Is that about right? Be back at a quarter to two by my math. Okay, we're in recess until a quarter to two. Thank you very much.